on the topic of Ukraine. Now, I'm not against it. However, I'm not positive that this person has done their research as much as I think they ought to have, because I'm not sure, but I think they think that I'm all over the anti-Russia narrative and not the way other way around. I want, not that it's really even the other way around, but I think they think that I would allow someone to come on here and spout off about how Russia's engaged in genocide. This is what the claim was. That Russia is engaged in genocide, that Russia is stealing babies. They sent me a video to watch, and I don't know if any of you understand, I shouldn't say stuff like that. That's pitiful for me to say stuff like that, and I shouldn't. You can understand whatever it is that is presented to you, but the issue is a lot of people don't know, or a lot of people didn't pay attention way back when everybody was wandering around. A lot of news today about Trump and saying that the people with the blue and yellow flags are silent on the death of the white girl in, what was it, North Carolina? We'll get to that in a little bit. But the hypocrisy is what he was claiming, is that there's just hypocrisy on all of that. And it only counts. You know, you don't want to say anything if it's anti-crime wave and a Ukrainian girl who ran away from war in Ukraine comes here and gets killed. There's some guy sending me stuff the world just seems upside down today. Or they haven't been paying attention to what they're not picking up what I'm putting down, especially in the last week when I've been pretty, or maybe they are because I've seen a pretty good spike in my, maybe I'm about to be trolled. I don't know. And I know that my article came out in Russia, and I know that the TV, deal came out with my interview on Russian television. And so I suppose it's possible that I'm getting trolled because I don't know. And so I haven't responded yet. And I'm sorry to be so open about it. I don't really have much to hide. I don't really care. And just put out something. But it'd be, I got halfway through writing this, response to see what I would do. And it was like, basically, well, you know, I'll talk to just about anybody. By the way, if you wish to phone in, the number is 573-746-8020. And I'd be happy to chat with you if you know, whatever topic, I don't really care. I have some, topics in the can, you know, things I do wish to go through and that I want to talk all about, but nothing in any seriousness. I mean, a lot of times I'll put together a full program for you, but then I got sidetracked by this. It was only about an hour and a half ago that I got this what I thought was a rather strange email. By the way, if you do wish to get in touch with me by email, that is samuelt@internationalflavor.com. And I'd be, you know, happy to, you know, chat back and forth by that. Like I said, call-ins 573-746-8020. I always get the 80. You can have the 20. And we can discuss whatever you would like. But there's just a weird feeling of things going on, and I've got this weird guest list that I wish to, I think I would like to invite the guy on, but now I might have ruined it, you know, because I say he's going to come on, and now I've said, you know, the guy's got these pro-Ukraine. So the first part of this video, and I'm not going to rat out the video or anything, maybe we will in a little bit, but so here's the first part of the video is Bucha. And if you don't know what Bucha is a city in East Ukraine, and the narrative that the West passed out forever, you know, after this event occurred, was that Russians were slaughtering people and right in the street and just, you know, just murdering everybody. And the unfortunate part is for people who pump that narrative is that it has been disproved over and over and over that it's not what was going on. And that is not what happened. And the Russians were 3 days gone from Bucha and had turned it over. This was during the initial stages after they had withdrawn from several places after they had sort of a tentative agreement in Istanbul the first time around. Before Boris Johnson, or Bojo as I call him, wandered his butt into Kiev and told the Z-man that he needed to keep on trucking. We need to keep this war machine cranking. And by the way, he wasn't alone. There's a lot of ultra-nationalists in Ukraine, and there were more then. You know, that that they might not be as vocal now, or maybe they're more vocal now, because Z-Man's been saying some interesting, he's been giving some interesting commentary as well. And so I wanted to share with you the article, because I wrote two articles for Russian newspapers, and let's see, one of them was published here, what I do is I take my deep dives and then I convert them into a written format, you know, whatever it have, you know, 1500, 2500 words, whatever. And then I, you know, to get because my Sunday deep dives, I do a little bit of research. It's not like, hey, geez, it's Monday night. Just get together and start talking on the radio and pray for somebody to call in, you know, kind of like today. No, I'm kidding. That's not the truth at all. But like last night, I did the, and it was pre-recorded because I was doing a little traveling. But last night, I kind of did a little bit of a deeper dive. I wanted to go into what the deeper dive was in a written part. You know, last night was talking about how you run for office depends on which country you're in. And I was pretty negative about what I feel about Ukraine's alleged democracy. You know, if Americans think we're fighting for democracy in Ukraine, that's a problem. There is no democracy there. And, you know, it's you can always go back and listen to all my shows. I stand by everything I say. You can go back and listen to internationalflavor.com and go back to last night's show was called Democracy's Hunger Games. You could go back to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which was a few days ago. And then one that has gotten a whole lot of popularity is this one on RIC, Russia, India, China, and them being the central of BRICS, which was my deep dive last Sunday, not yesterday, but a week ago. And that one has got a lot of play. Well, that one I have in kind of an article that I would like to share with you on that particular one, if I can get to it, which I'll try to do real quick. I didn't bring my glasses. Wait a minute. Wait. Oh, JR left some, or somebody did, but I'm stealing whoever's they are. And basically, and this isn't a long article, so I'm going to give it to you, but I submitted this in Russian and another one too. But this I think is important, and it's important enough to do twice anyway, even if it is a slight bit of repeat, but not a whole lot. And I added a couple of whatever you want to call them, projects that didn't take flight, as it were, in America. So let's start. And the title of this article is called "The New World is Being Built in Steel and Concrete, and Washington, Our Fearless Leaders, They Are Not Invited." They haven't been invited. And it's the subtitle is "The Deals America Won't or Can't Make." And it's by Samuel Trapp. And basically, here, this is my article. The images from Alaska were irresistible. Donald Trump greeting Vladimir Putin on a red carpet, giving him the first word at their press conference, and riding with him in a limousine. To Washington pundits, this was weakness, even surrender. To me, it looked like recognition. Recognition that America no longer presides over the global boardroom alone. And that while Washington is trapped in endless debate, others are pouring concrete, laying rails, welding pipelines. The central contest of this century, I believe this, by the way, or I wouldn't have written it, is not about who delivers the sharpest soundbite or the stiffest sanction. It is about who builds the infrastructure of the future. Whoever lays the tracks, constructs the ports, and wires the reactors, writes the rules of trade. And on that scoreboard, America is slipping. These are the deals America won't or can't make. Rick builds, America talks. At the heart of BRICS lies the tight nucleus of Russia, India, and China. RIC is not a debating club. It is three governments that see, plan, build. Each brings different strength. Russia resources, India demographics, China finance and manufacturing. Together, they are reshaping the map of Eurasia and the world. Take the international north-south transport corridor. Freight train leaves Mumbai, goes through Iran, arrives Moscow, 40% faster, 30% cheaper than by the western-led Suez Canal. The only missing piece is a small 162-kilometer stretch between Rasht and Astara, and it is being financed and built by Russia. The deals are signed. The work is underway. America, meanwhile, debates whether to fund Amtrak bathrooms. These are the deals America won't or can't make. Consider the Chabahar port, operated by India under a 10-year lease signed in 2024. For India, it bypasses Pakistan. For Iran, ties them into Eurasia. For Russia, it locks another link into the global transport chain. Washington would never approve such a project. Congress would sanction it before the ink dried. America won't make such a deal. Look east to the Eastern Maritime Corridor, Chennai-Vladivostok shipping lane, that trims more than 2 weeks off of travel times. Indian firms are already investing in Russia's Far East. This is to the disadvantage of Japan and Korea. America sails the Pacific with carriers, but hasn't built a new corridor there in generations. Then energy. In Tamil Nadu, Russia's Rosatom is building the Kudankulam nuclear power plant. Six reactors, largest in India. Six vessels, that final one arrived in 2025. Each reactor binds India and China to a 60-year contract of fuel engineering maintenance. These are commitments America won't or can't make. In Siberia, gas flows east through the Power of Siberia pipeline. A second line, Power of Siberia 2, is planned through Mongolia, capable of delivering 50 billion cubic meters a year. No SWIFT, no dollars, no American leverage. RIC is definitely not flawless. Each country has its own style of politics, its own imperfections, even disagreement with one another. Yet they set those aside and pursue mutual benefit. They understand that building together today creates strength in the present and stability for the future. The very act of cooperation tends to reduce conflict. America, by contrast, insists on solving every quarrel first. So we end up solving nothing at all. That is why these are the deals America won't or cannot make. The Western Hemisphere without vision. Now compare the Western Hemisphere. If Washington had any imagination, it would be knitting together the Americas with new rail corridors and ports. Instead, the most consequential projects here are either corporate mergers, decade-long national slogs, or Chinese state investment. The Canadian Pacific Kansas City merger, CPKC, in 2023, created the first single-line railroad linking Canada, U.S., and Mexico. 20,000 route miles, auto and grain flowing. Useful? Certainly. Transformative? No. It was a corporate merger, not a mega project. A bookkeeping deal, not a civilizational one. Ports to Plains Corridor, future Interstate 27, from Texas to Mexico. The ports in Mexico, the ports in Houston, the ports on the Gulf is where they're supposed to go, okay? Just so you know what that is. It's existed on maps for decades. Excuse me, but only one federally approved segment was announced in 2024, finally. Meanwhile, Eurasian trains are already running. America won't or can't make such deals. Brazil finished its own north-south railway in 2023. Took 30 years. It links soy fields to Atlantic ports, but Washington had nothing to do with it. Brazil struggled alone, inch by inch, because no U.S. vision was on the table. In Argentina, the Belgrano Cargas revival was financed by Chinese loans and locomotives. In Peru, $3.5 billion Chancay Megaport opened in 2024, majority owned by China's Costco. These are the most significant new arteries of the hemisphere, and they're carrying Beijing stamp, not Washington. Then there are the projects that almost happened. Keystone XL Pipeline, designed to carry Canadian crude south to U.S. refineries. Years in the planning, billions into construction. On the very day President Biden took office, the permit was revoked. Not because the steel in the ground had changed, but because the political winds of change had blown. A decade of investment written off as a partisan casualty, a symbolic knife into the back of the outgoing president. That is not planning. It is vandalism. And it is why America not only won't make these deals, it just can't. And at home, the story is even worse. The mirage of high-speed rail. California approved a Los Angeles-San Francisco bullet train in 2008. Cost? $33 billion. Completion date? 2020. Today, the cost is over $100 billion and counting. The route has been truncated from L.A. to Bakersfield. That's nowhere. And the project is a national punchline. It's a freaking joke. Texas has been developing a Houston-Dallas high-speed rail line since the 90s. It remains tied up in lawsuits and financing. Amtrak's Acela average, that's the one on the East Coast, averages slower than Japan's Shinkansen did in the 60s. China, in less than two decades, has built 26,000 miles of high-speed rail. in America during the same span, although it's been projected, we have built zero. It's not just that America won't commit, it's that it cannot. Every mile of track is a bargaining chip. Every contract must satisfy unions, contractors, and above all, politicians. No senator gets reelected for letting someone else control the purse strings. Projects die of politics before a single train rolls, or they're killed when the new president takes office. That's the essence of America's cannot. Why America doesn't build? The reasons America doesn't build are both structural and political. First, decentralization. Nearly 80% of U.S. infrastructure spending is controlled by state and local government. Washington provides grants but doesn't design continental corridors. There is no U.S. equivalent. This is laughable, people. There is no U.S. equivalent to China's Belt and Roads Initiative, which is global, by the way. They'd probably invest in us, or Europe's 10T. There isn't even a coherent national port strategy. Nothing. Second, permitting paralysis. Environmental review and lawsuits stretch on for years. California's rail saga isn't an anomaly. It's the system functioning as it was designed. Third is political capture. Legislators treat infrastructure as patronage. Projects exist to funnel money to favored contractors and districts. Long term, depoliticized planning is impossible because no one in Washington wins an election by giving up control of the purse strings. Fourth, foreign policy blindness. America has decided to hate Russia, to prepare for war with China, to treat India as though Narendra Modi were a junior cousin at a family barbecue. Washington cannot bring itself to treat anyone as its equal partner. Instead, it spends political capital denouncing systems it cannot control. Russia's presidency, China's party state, India's messy nationalism, while the rest of the world quietly concludes that hegemony is already dead. Maybe a 25-year presidency isn't right for America, but wasting energy condemning models of others abroad only ensures nothing gets built at home. And finally, tariffs and sanctions. Washington reaches for them as a substitute for strategy and diplomacy. Tariffs raise costs at home. Sanctions change little abroad. Sanctions, in truth, have no place in building the future. But if they are to exist, at least impose them symmetrically on both sides of any conflict until peace is signed. Equal pressure to end a war that others have failed to resolve for centuries. Equal pressure on both to end wars that others have failed to resolve for centuries. Otherwise, sanctions become just another way America proves what it will not or cannot do. So let's tally the results. In Asia, the INSTC, Chabahar, Eastern Maritime Corridor, Kudankulam, Power of Siberia. In Africa, Chinese loans built Kenya's SRG, Ethiopia's Addis to Djibouti rail. Latin America, Argentina rail, Peru's megaport are Chinese finance. Brazil rail took 3 decades. America contributed nothing to any of these. In the U.S., one rail merger, one half-planned interstate, one pipeline killed for politics, and 0 miles of high-speed rail. If global influence is measured by military basis, Washington still leads. If it is measured by who builds the arteries of trade, scoreboard is clear. Eurasia's acting, America won't, and increasingly America cannot. So I've created an open letter, let's call it my Shark Tank pitch to Donald Trump, Donald Jayevich. If Washington refuses to build, maybe the idea should be pitched a little more directly. Call it my idea. Call it Western Hemisphere Infrastructure Development Initiative, a continental rail spine, new ports, true high-speed rail. Why not treat it like an episode of Shark Tank? Put the proposal on the table. Invite Donald Trump to hear the pitch. Ask Elon Musk, a man who actually builds things, to lead the charge. He understands engineering, scale, and speed. Trump understands deals and spectacle. Together, they could assemble capital and cut through inertia. That's a possibility, you know. I say this facetiously, but, you know, it's possible. Washington will scoff. Congress will block. After all, no senator gets his cut if politics are removed. That's the reason America not only won't make these deals, it can't. Donald Trump, to his credit, has the instinct to end the Ukraine war, a conflict that bleeds America and enriches contractors. That instinct should be sharpened. If sanctions must exist, let them fall on both Moscow and Kyiv until peace is signed. Equal pressure, equal urgency, a deal instead of a blank check. And then move beyond it. Compartmentalize. Separate the issues. Stop treating 1,000 years of fluid European borders as if they're America's eternal duty to police. Build the future instead of patrolling the past. Propose an upgraded pipeline system into Europe, not as a weapon, but as an artery of peace, binding economies together for jobs, stability, and the security of our children. That would be the deal to end all deals. Not sanctions forever, not wars without end, but steel, energy, commerce, and peace. These are the deals America should be making, not the deals America won't or can't make. And that is the end of the article. So I wrote that and submitted it after, you know, I made some additions to what I was talking about last week. Oh, geez. Last Sunday, I guess that was 7-8 days ago. And I added, because I didn't miss high-speed rail. I only peripherally mentioned high-speed rail. But, geez, what a joke. I mean, in all seriousness, how long? Now I'm, you know, inching up there in age, friends and neighbors. And it's been quite a while that I have seen in the United States that our bridges are crap, right? Our bridges are falling apart. They've been around for, you know, years and years, and there's not enough infrastructure to, or dollars, or will, or, and in fact, there is no central planning. Did you know this? I, while researching for these things, and I didn't mention them last week, but while researching for these things, we don't even have a national planning group. Nothing. I mean, think about this. If that little quote that says that, what do you call it? American dollars, American funding for projects is 80% of it sent on to the states, right? This money is sent to the states. And the states get to plan internally what they do. That the U.S. will issue grants. And remember, part of this is our structure. Don't think I'm anti our structure. Don't think I want to go to state-owned everything. I don't. But the fact is that our system sometimes, or in reality, sometimes, that's not even the right word, doesn't allow us to do these sorts of projects, to create something. We have to, what happens? Why is it that, and we all complain about it tons. We complain and complain and complain. Think about this. And rightly so, by the way, because we send money to, Jim Bob, cousin of Senator Joe Bob, right? That's who gets the project. That's who gets the deal and gets to hire. You know, it's a political handout to whoever's in charge. You have these government. I forget what they call the system. The SAMS system. I can't remember. The SAM system is where you register online to become a U.S. contractor. And I might have the name wrong. It's been a long time since I looked at it. And I was registered on it for quite a while to do some project work or to be an interpreter or something like that, right? And but that is supposed to make it fair. Who gets what? But yeah, we all know that isn't how it happens. You know that your huge road project in Missouri gets funneled to the right people. You know, the right lobbyists have to be taken care of with the right backing for the right politician to the right group. And maybe that has its own set of efficiencies. Let's say it that way. They have their own sets of efficiency that come with that. If you know the right people or those people already have it, but all too often it turns needed a sip of water. The system takes a project and funnels it to a person, then that person will, you know, jump in the project. It's far more about having a top-heavy group of people that get to be part of the deal. Like high-speed rail, I imagine that high-speed rail being at 100 billion already and having gotten nowhere, I'm sure it's full of top-heavy, very top-heavy in California because you can't afford to live there anyway. And so they get the funding from the U.S., and then they all go to work for a number of years, and that's that. They all go to work. They've all had jobs. So here's what my prediction is. My prediction is that these yahoos will move on to the next project. So they're gonna go on to the, you know, this will be a positive for them. They will step into the next government boondoggle in California or wherever. This is exactly what's going to happen. Crazy stuff. Anyway, I wanted to share that today as part of segment one. And, well, that is all of segment one. Friends and neighbors, Romans and countrymen. I always wondered who the Romans would be and who are the countrymen. Weren't they all in the same group? So if you were the Romans, wouldn't you be the countrymen too? It's a very curious question. Why has everything switched to Russian? Here I am trying to share something with you, and I'm not going to read it to you in Russian. Son of a nutcracker. See what happens when you are in the studio and you're trying to get your poop in a group, as they say, and isn't. we're gonna try this again. Hold on, see if I can reopen, and it will open in English. There you have it. Let's see. Trump Jr. has slammed the Ukrainian flag clowns. Okay. The U.S. president's son has accused social media activists of hypocrisy. Yes. He has criticized social media users who display the Ukrainian flag in their profile but remain silent about the recent killing of a young Ukrainian woman in North Carolina. Irina Zarutskaya, who fled Ukraine after escalation of conflict in 2022, was fatally stabbed on August 22 riding a Charlotte light rail train. Surveillance released by the authorities over the weekend show her being ambushed and attacked from behind. Did you see this? This was horror story. It just happened to end up in. I saw it in my YouTube. And Trump Jr. says, strangely, all the clowns with Ukraine flags in their bio are all silent on this one. He said. His post came in response to a conservative podcast host, Liz Wheeler, who shared a screenshot of a New York Times search for the victim's name. And that was interesting, too. So when Liz Wheeler was searched for, if you search for George Floyd, 5,897 hits. Trayvon Martin, 1,190. Kilmar Obrego Garcia, 56. New York Times propaganda search for Irina Zarutskaya, 0. Irina Zarutskaya, 0 results. Now, I would have to say that it doesn't look like it's spelled properly, though, so it makes you wonder if Irina Zarutskaya, maybe she doesn't know how to search for it right, this Liz Wheeler. So, not to justify, because I don't, but at the same time, the post came in response to conservative podcast host Liz Wheeler on the New York Times, but it was spelled wrong, okay? And there are thousands of articles and information about George Floyd. President Trump also addressed the killing in a statement on Truth Social, where he called the video horrific, and it is, and they shouldn't put it out there, in my opinion, and blames Democratic leaders for enabling repeat offenders to remain on the streets through policies such as cashless bail. Cashless bail. I tell you what, if I went to jail, it wouldn't be cashless bail. I bet you anything. Now her blood is on the hands of the Democrats who refuse to put bad people in jail, he wrote. Also questioned why the mainstream media was silent on this case. Both Trump and his son have framed the incident as an example of selective outrage and double standards in U.S. politics and media, particularly in cases involving victims who do not fit prevailing political narrative. Guy that got arrested is a black guy named Carlos Brown, long criminal history, charged with first-degree murder. But there was a companion commentary on this. Remembering Irina, when does murder get ignored? When the victim is white and the killer is black. And I don't necessarily agree in that. This is an article I'm sharing with you. U.S. mainstream media tends to operate by encouraging a certain prefabricated outrage. Sensationalized narratives are cultivated along predictable track. But no less egregious is what the media chooses to ignore. Few events of late have better exposed the ideological underpinnings of the media and of the elite whose narratives it plugs than the recent brutal and shocking murder of a young Ukrainian woman on a train in Charlotte, North Carolina. On August 22, a career criminal, DeCarlos Brown Jr., casually walked up behind 23-year-old Ukrainian refugee Irina Zarutskaya,
who was seated on a train minding her own business and stabbed her 3 times in the neck in cold blood, killing her. He sauntered away, still clutching the knife, dripping blood. The mindless and savage attack was captured on surveillance footage, but Charlotte's Democratic mayor, Vi Lyles, pushed for it not to be released, ostensibly out of respect for the victim's family. I happen to agree. I don't think it should have been released. But the footage did eventually surface, and the story spread like wildfire. But this was wildfire that couldn't reach the impervious redoubt of the mainstream media. Even after Elon Musk gave it the push into viral territory by chiming in on an end wokeness thread, pointing out the media silence. In fact, not a single major legacy outlet, the New York Times, the Washington Post, NPR, Reuters, CNN, Wall Street Journal, or others, picked it up. Not one. One would think that by sheer chance, one of these outlets would have bucked the trend. But that didn't happen because, as Matt Taibbi once brilliantly pointed out, reporting is done in herds. No one wildebeest can break formation without screwing things up for the others. So they all hold the line until they all stop holding the line. As of this writing, it seems the media herd is starting to reluctantly skate to where the puck is going. And that means that some version of the story, however sanitized, will appear soon everywhere. So what exactly has given this story its irresistible momentum? Let's start with the blatant double standard about reporting interracial crime. A white victim and a black perpetrator, as was the case in this instance, is usually a circumstance that tips the scale in favor of silence. When an instance of black-on-white crime cannot be avoided, the respective races of the individuals involved are not mentioned, and the tone is more along the lines of, oh shucks, what a tragedy. When the racial roles are reversed, the media coverage is extensive and sensational, and the race angle is established immediately and runs throughout the ensuing coverage like an electric wildfire. Given such highly distorted media coverage of interracial crime, one would be forgiven for assuming that it is blacks who are perpetually in mortal danger of racist attacks by whites in the U.S. This view was a large part of the impetus behind the Black Lives Matter movement. However, the actual statistics on interracial crime, which are not easy to find, show otherwise. Buried inside this DOJ report from 2020 is a rather remarkable admission. In 2019, there were 5.3 times as many violent incidents committed by black offenders against white victims, 472,570 of them, as were committed by white offenders against black victims, 89,980 incidents. Such stark wording was not repeated in subsequent reports under the Biden DOJ. But there's no reason to believe anything has changed in the street. Zarutska's murder certainly comes at the time of record low American trust in the mainstream media. I'm one of those, by the way. I don't trust a word that those yahoos have to say. Instances of misreporting and factual disasters have become such a recurrent theme as to not require individual example. The media's efforts at narrative formation have also become so heavy-handed that identifying the establishment cause being promoted in almost any piece of reporting is now a parlor game. But the uproar over this senseless killing also points to a deeply ensconced taboo slowly starting to unravel. Many white Americans are tired of being denied the right to display even the slightest and most tentative hint of the type of racial solidarity that other groups are extended so liberally. It is a story being played out on a different stage with different actors in Great Britain. There's another angle here, and it's one that has already been remarked upon in numerous places. The victim was a citizen of a country that the U.S. has spent enormous treasure and effort ostensibly defending since 2022. The roughly $130 billion in aid that Washington has coughed up for Kyiv comes out to some $3,500 per Ukrainian citizen. Certainly enough for a bodyguard on a train ride. Now, that shouldn't laugh about that, but I like that line. And yet, the silence from a pro-Ukraine crowd has mirrored that of the media at large. This confirms what has been abundantly clear throughout the war and remains so today. Ukrainian deaths that do not advance a Western elite media narrative are dismissed and ignored. This lack of reaction casts in sharp relief the reality that pro-Ukraine sentiment in the U.S. is largely a cause bundled in with the rest of the progressive agenda. I think it's worse than that, frankly. But it's underpinned by the uniform mouthpiece of a jaded media. The Ukrainian flags one sees out and about rarely reflect a principled stance, but rather a deference to elite cues, which is what I was talking about in the very beginning when I got that email out of the blue with a link to just blatant, I'm sure well-funded, blatant BS, probably funded by Western previously, probably got funded by U.S. Agency for International Development cash or National Endowment for Democracy or some crap like that. I'm sure the U.S. has funded that thing. And they would never fund any story that I wanted to do. Let's say while I was in Russia a week ago that I had decided to do a story on, I don't know what, because they exist too, friends and neighbors. Say a Russian soldier who was tortured and released by Ukrainians during a prisoner swap. Why don't we find one of those and do it? Would the U.S. fund me for that? Oh, no. But they sure as hell will the other way around. If I asked for money, if I sent something and said, listen, I want to talk about, because in the beginning, when this all happened in 2022, the Russians were all up in arms, and rightly so. And videos were everywhere. You could probably still find them on Telegram, if you went out and had to look for them. And I'm sorry to interrupt this article. There's only a couple more paragraphs of it, but I don't want to lose this train of thought because I'm telling you, the fact is that there were some evil things that happened when the Russians were being attacked by the Ukrainians. And you know, which is, I mean, it really did happen. They were having their testicles cut off and put in their pockets. They were there were videos of them being shot like dogs in the street. They're laying down. They've done. They would capture them. They would torture them. They would urinate on them. They would force them to do nasty things or and. Use your imagination. It's disgusting. And there were videos of all of these things. But you weren't allowed to talk about that. But you're absolutely able to do what this guy sent to me. I mean, and I suppose what caught me a little off guard when getting that video today was when I opened it up because, you know, it says the guy's the guy that once talked to me is has been in Ukraine since the escalation by Russia moving into the Donbass, and that he's been following the you know, he's a press reporter and he goes around and videos it all. And then when he does, he's able to put it out in America or everywhere else. And so you can't tell. And he's been there the whole 3 years, apparently. And so he's sending me footage of Bucha. Okay, and Bucha occurred way back in April or maybe March of 2022. And the video of that has been debunked repeatedly. Like I said, Russia, even a lot of the Western media that has reviewed it has refuted what was said. Lavrov talks about it all the time. He says, but yeah, but it's been refuted, but nobody will acknowledge that it's been refuted. And even in the West, nobody believes it. But people are still pumping it out to get money for more money for Ukraine. So the guy had 3 points to his story. One, people are dying. Yep, I get that. I think that's very sad. Two, Bucha. Bucha's not the truth, friends and neighbors. Well, you know what they, what, and by the way, I don't want to say it's all right, even if it was, because it's not. But if you believe it, you got serious problems, the same as it would be if you were here in the U.S. just believing what mainstream media pumped up your, you know, rear end for you to believe. You know, you just somebody who flips on the news, go, geez, did you see that on news yesterday? And that's it. You don't research, you don't cross-check any sort of reference. That thing on the Pinocchio meter would it'd have a 4 foot long Pinocchio nose on that. They put bodies in there that were weeks old and had them as if they were laying and strewn across the street. And everybody who saw, go look up Bucha and look up what is as part of it. Bucha, Bucha, and check it out. That was part one. Part two, he's talking about, and it was pretty blatant. You know, here's Russians are stealing all these Ukrainian kids and then taking them into Russia. They stole 20-something thousand. They're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands. The Russians have been saying, look, give us one name. Give us some names of some kids. And finally, just this last year, this has been going on forever. And just this last year, at one of the exchanges in Istanbul, back, you know, when they were talking a couple, 3 months ago, they provided a list of 39 names. 39 names of children. And Russia has been saying and putting out pretty regularly, listen, we, you know, any children that were picked, because there was a, back during that time, there was an orphanage in the Donbass region somewhere, and I truly don't remember where the Russians took control of it, and the children were just left. They were left. Now, I don't know how you justify that. You know, I suppose it's a government, you know, it was a government, orphanage. And maybe those children should have been, they absolutely should have been taken care of instead of just left. And the Russian soldiers came in and took them. And then the Russians say, we did have this and there were a number of children in there. And we brought them here and would, you know, try to reunite them, whether their families are dead or whether they're whatever. And there was zero cooperation from the Ukraine side, according to the Russians. Now, I'm not there. I don't know the truth of any of that. But there are two competing sides, and there always are two competing sides of who says what and what the truth really is. And so to believe those things. So basically, all of the things that they had listed from the Bucha, from the orphanage issue, were, I mean, highly refuted. And so the email I began to draft back, and I haven't decided what I'm going to do with it. Now I certainly can't tell you. I have no idea what I'm going to do. But I don't know that it would do any good to talk to a person like this, you know, because obviously they're very committed to what they're doing. He's over there, you know, according to the paperwork they sent to me to get me to interview him. It's been 3 years that he's been over there, that he's been reporting on all this. And I'm going to review more of his content and check it out and see what can be seen on that end. But and it might be fun to have a discussion on that anyway, with somebody with an opposing point of view to me. I have no problem with that. I think it could be pretty enlightening or informative. I mean, I'm not against learning more. Maybe he'll convince me of something that's a little bit different than what I think, right? So, well, let's see. Where I wanted to finish this article real quick. The lack of reaction. Let's see. Ukrainian deaths that don't advance our Western elite media narrative are dismissed and ignored. But this lack of reaction also casts in sharp relief the reality that pro-Ukraine sentiment in the U.S. is largely a cause bundled in with the rest of the progressive agenda, underpinned by the uniform mouthpiece of a jaded media. The Ukrainian flag one sees out and about rarely reflects a principled stance, but rather deference to elite cues. That's where I got distracted. It will be said that all sides have merely assumed their positions on the barricades to score political points on this deeply human tragedy. We will all be accused of coming to praise Caesar rather than to bury him. This young woman's death is indeed a human tragedy and a particularly painful one. But to see it as only a tragedy is to dismiss its larger context and to refuse to draw conclusions. That is willful ignorance. When a tragedy unveils such a confluence of two deep ideological biases, what it does is reveal the contours of the magnet moving underneath the pattern of American life. Now, I like that article. That's why I shared it with you. And written by a guy named Henry Johnston. And I enjoyed the article and thought I would share it with you. And it, you know, that video kind of dominated the media over the weekend, and Trump made some comments on it that was really not that long ago. When did he do this? He accused Democrats of here you go. This came out three hours ago. The U.S. president accused Democrats of letting a mentally deranged lunatic roam the street. Trump has condemned the fatal stabbing of this Ukrainian woman as a horrific act committed by a mentally deranged lunatic, according to a statement posted on his Monday's Truth Social. The victim, Irina Zarutskaya, left Ukraine after the escalation in 2022, killed on August 22, while riding the Lynx Blue Line. Trump referenced the footage in both his social media post and during a public speech in Washington, D.C., saying the suspect had been arrested and released 14 times on cashless bail and should not have been free at the time of the killing. What the hell was he doing riding the train and walking the streets? Criminals like this need to be locked up, Trump wrote. The blood of this innocent woman can literally be seen dripping from the killer's knife. And now her blood is on the hands of Democrats who refuse to put bad people in jail, including former disgraced governor and wannabe Senator Roy Cooper, he said. Charlotte Mecklenburg police have charged Brown with first-degree murder. Actually, police don't charge anyone. Officials say he had a long criminal history, including armed robbery, previously served more than 6 years in prison. A judge ordered him to undergo psychiatric eval earlier this year, but the assessment was never completed. Trump criticized media response to the killing, saying, "Where's the outrage from the mainstream media on this horrible tragedy?" During his remarks at the Museum of the Bible, he said, by the way, JR, I heard that today. That was pretty good. "We're all people of religion, but there are evil people. We have to confront that. If we don't handle that, we don't have a country." Zarutska bled out and died at the scene. Suspect was taken into custody shortly after the attack, currently being held in Mecklenburg detention. Sad and horrible story. Let's see. I saw something. I'm going to change topics a little bit on this because I have my own personal interest in this. And I saw an article today that I wished to share with you on ChatGPT because I've been thinking about it for, I don't know if any of you use it, but I do use ChatGPT and I use Grok and there's one more. I use some professional ones too that are for a professional company. And this AI does these things it calls hallucination. And I might have said something about this a couple, 3 weeks ago. It was pretty comical. Excuse me. Because I got... I got into an argument with my AI and started going, "Look, why are you telling me stuff that isn't true? Why are you telling me things that you can't, you know, you can't back up?" And I said, "I have heard that this is called hallucination. Can you explain why you are hallucinating? And can you explain things to me?" And what it said was, sorry, need another sip, was that basically it hallucinates because when it goes out to find the answer, sometimes there is a delay and they go back and look at other people's questions and it's trying to learn as it goes along. And it said it was a completely BS answer. And so basically it says, and it always puts it this way. Maybe it's the type of, the method in which I have it reply to me, you know, is a general, I don't know, general topic of a fairly positive or whatever. And it always comes back if you call it on something and it's wrong, especially in ChatGPT. If you call on it in ChatGPT, this hallucination, and you say, "Wait a minute, why are you giving me things that aren't true?" And I was researching some, doing some legal research on something, and it was citing to me cases that did not exist. Three of them, and by the way, this is an issue for in England, I might have told you about this, it was several months ago. There was a ruling from the High Court in England where the court disciplined two attorneys, for using AI law cases that didn't exist. That the one of them was pretty extensive, apparently, that it was all fake crap. And so the lawyer, whoever these lawyers were not checking their work. So that's, I mean, lawyers can't use, you know, ChatGPT to do all their, do their, or any sort of AI to do it, at least not without checking it. And so I'm asking the AI why, you know, why you're hallucinating. And the AI comes back with a completely BS answer. And it has no basis in truth to what it is, but it says it very positively. It says it to me, well, you know, thank you for catching that. I'm glad you caught that. Thanks. You know, here go. Why the hell am I going to say anything to you if you're giving me lies anyway? And it's what in the world are you saying to me that I have to go and verify? Now I get it from the point of view of the other stuff, but I've done a decent amount of research into this and going and trying to find out why AI comes up with fakes. And now I saw an article today. Excuse me. That says, OpenAI explains the reason for chatbot hallucination. This just came out. Language models have been conditioned to hazard wild guesses instead of admitting ignorance, a study has found. So, well, gee, I want to help, and so if I don't have an answer, I'll just create one. Sounds like some lawyers I know. Let's see. The company behind ChatGPT has addressed the persistent problem of artificial intelligence models generating plausible but false statements that it calls hallucination. In a statement on Friday, OpenAI explained that models are typically encouraged to hazard a guess, however improbable. The dog ate my homework would be a good answer, I suppose, as opposed to acknowledging that they cannot answer a question. So they make jokes and say this is like having a, what was it, an Einstein in your pocket or something, or having a, you know, I forget what they call it, but what's the use of having an Einstein in your pocket if, you know, he's on mushrooms? You know, there's no sense in that. So the issue is attributable to the core principles underlying standard training and evaluation procedures, said the company. OpenAI has revealed that the instances where language models confidently generate an answer that isn't true have continued to plague even newer, more advanced iterations, including the latest flagship GPT-5 system. According to the findings of a recent study, the problem is rooted in the way language models' performance is usually evaluated at present, with the guessing model ranked higher than a careful one that admits uncertainty. Under standard protocol, AI systems learn that failure to generate an answer is a surefire way to get 0 points on a test, while an unsubstantiated guess might just prove to be correct. Well, that's what your teachers always tell you if you're taking a multiple guess test, right? So you have this multiple guess test. And they always say, don't leave a multiple guess blank. You got to answer it. Why? Well, because you could be wrong. Or you could, you know, there's a chance you could get it right just by guessing, right? So apparently that's what AI has been trained to do, is make these kind of rash decisions to make sure that you get something rather than get nothing. So all I do is say, you know, AI has done some very wonderful things, and I have used it to Usually, the only time I use AI is to accumulate information that I have already put together, like summarize a... It'd be perfect, for example, for a child in high school forced to read Plato and the works of Aristotle or something like that, where you could take the handout that your teacher gave you and scan it into GPT and say, okay, here's this 30 pages my teacher gave it to me. Can you consolidate it into a one-page summary for me? That is useful. No substitute for doing your homework, of course, but that I don't believe I have ever had the AI come up with information that was not in the document or in whatever the document was. So you can, you know, using it for something like that, that's a bit of a different deal. I wanted to say a little bit about the Z-Man. I haven't talked a lot about the Z-Man lately, and I did I wonder if I can fit it into what I have remaining on time. I think I might be able to. Or have I gone too far? I wanted to this morning go through the Z-Man's commentary because he was being pretty rough on Trump this morning in some of the things that he said. And here he claimed that Donald Trump's decision to... there were quite a few things about him. This one was about putting 25% more tariffs on India. And I notice, again, would point out that if we are sanctioning somebody, or I'm sorry, tariffing somebody, it's India. The China ones have been put off for 90 days. Doesn't make a lot of sense, but they are. And Zelensky came back and said that the decision to impose penalty tariffs on India for buying Russian oil is the right thing to do. In an interview, because he's always over here glad-handing somebody to try to get more news and sympathy and, more importantly, money for his, you know, Project Ukraine. In an interview on ABC News with Martha Raddatz, which was aired last night, he said, like he always does, additional pressure is needed on President Putin, mentioning last week's Shanghai Cooperation Summit, SCO, that I told you about the other day in China. Raddatz asked, when you saw Prime Minister Modi there, who has helped Russia, so did the plan backfire of trying to put sanctions on them? In response, Zelensky said, I think the idea to put tariffs on countries who continue to make deals with Russia, this is the right idea. The U.S. has imposed duties on most Indian products, which include 25% tariff announced in early August, followed by an additional 25% penalty at the end of the month for India's purchase of Russian oil and defense equipment, action that Trump claims have indirectly fueled the Ukraine conflict. The fueling of the Ukraine conflict, by the way, is Western activity. It has nothing to do with India Okay. I sit back and I listen to this stuff and it's like, oh Jesus, who are we going to blame next for the Ukraine war? Is anybody ever going to stand up and say what really caused? Is anybody ever going to discuss the root cause of this conflict? Is it going to happen? Will we talk about it? Is anybody going to talk about it? Is diplomacy ever going to happen, or are we going to do the same thing? We're going to go bad, bad, bad. You bad, we good. Period. That's the end. There, if you're bad, you're always bad. If you're bad, there is no single part of you that is good. You are all bad. And so India is now bad. We heard Besant say this the other day. Remember, he told us all of these people are bad actors. And everybody in the SCO is a bad actor. That's just nuts. Anyway, before going to Tianjin for the summit, Modi had a phone conversation with Zelensky, which the Indian leader said New Delhi extends full support to restore peace and stability in Ukraine. As far as the conflict in Ukraine is concerned, we welcome all recent efforts towards stabilizing peace in Ukraine, said Indian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Randhir Jaiswal on Friday. We hope that all parties will proceed ahead constructively. India supports an early end of the conflict and establishment of enduring peace. For his interview with ABC, Zelensky spoke out against other countries that continue to buy Russian oil and gas. To be open and clear, it's not fair. That's what he said. To be open and clear, it's not fair. So we have to stop to buy any kind of energy from Russia. We can't have any deals if we want to solve them, is what he said. The guy's delusional. Let's see. Let's talk about, allegedly, he's another article about him. Excuse me, I'm really all stuffed up. Don't know what's wrong with me. Getting sick, I suppose. Zelensky has insulted Trump. Is he suicidal? This is a question. Written by Nadezhda Romanenko, a political analyst, the Ukrainian leader risks alienating the only power besides Moscow with a real approach to ending the war. This was an interesting article, and I believe it's a little long, but I think I can get there. If I can continue to breathe, that would be nice. In a weekend interview on ABC News, Vladimir Zelensky accused Donald Trump of giving Russian President Putin what he wanted at the Alaska summit in August. Now, I've probably commented on the Alaska summit at least twice. If you want to go back and listen to it about my thoughts on what the Vladimir Putin received versus what he was given, I think that Trump did a hell of a job here. So I am not in agreement with anything about Zelensky making comments that Putin got just what he wanted. Although, it doesn't matter. Whether a passing complaint or a calculated jab, it may come at a steep cost for Zelensky. To suggest that Trump bent to Putin's will is to imply weakness, and weakness is something Trump never tolerates being accused of. This rhetorical swipe was directed at a man who holds significant sway over the trajectory of the Russia-Ukraine war. For Zelensky, the insult may prove more damaging than cathartic. Zelensky overestimates his leverage. He always does. But everybody backs him up. You know, this is the sad part. And Trump wishy-washy when it comes to some of this thing, in my opinion. Okay. Zelensky appears to believe that he has become indispensable in Trump's calculation, that Washington's policies revolve around Kyiv's demands. But this overstates his importance. Trump has been consistent about one priority. He wants the war to end, and more than that, and I agree with this, more than that, he wants the U.S. disentangled from it. His approach reflects the sentiment of much of the American public, certainly me, weary of sending weapons and aid overseas while domestic problems fester. By framing Trump's summit with Putin as a giveaway, Zelensky risks alienating the one Western leader positioned to shift the direction of the war. Trump is sensitive to personal slights. For years, allies and adversaries alike have learned that once he feels personally insulted, he hardens, not softens. Well, who wouldn't, by the way? To tell Trump, in effect, that he's Putin's stooge is to court precisely that reaction. Trump's efforts at the Alaska summit were grounded in political reality that Zelensky refuses to acknowledge. Here's why I'm reading you this article. The battlefield is not tilting in Kyiv's favor. Russia's position, bolstered by sheer resources and strategic depth, is proving resilient. Ukraine's European backers continue to speak in lofty terms like as long as it takes, but they lack the power to deliver Ukrainian victory. All true. None of them will get involved without the U.S., and the U.S., I won't say will not, but boy, it'd be idiotic if we did any more than we already are. And I really do believe that the old Trumpster wants out. And I know he wants out, but the easiest way to get out, I already said this, cut him off. Cut him off, sanction both sides, move on. That's it. It's over. Trump pursued a path that might actually move events forward. Direct talks with Russia. Engagement on security. Search for a negotiated framework. It's not an approach designed to satisfy Zelensky and the European maximalist goals, but rather one rooted in ending an exhausting conflict. To dismiss this effort as capitulation is to ignore that it may be the most realistic option still on the table. In the same interview, Zelensky says his vision for a Ukrainian victory is Ukraine's survival. Yet his strategy, as evident from his actions, appears geared less toward survival and more toward dragging the war on for as long as possible. Each new demand for weapons, each new appeal for sanctions, pushes the conflict forward without changing the battlefield reality of Russia grinding towards its objectives. And whatever Zelensky claims, total occupation of Ukraine is not one of those objectives. In the name of survival, Ukraine is exhausting its people, its infrastructure, and its economy. If survival truly is the goal, then ending the war must be the only priority. And right now, Trump has the best shot at it because he is realistically engaged with the interests of Russia, the side that has the clear upper hand on the battlefield. And Zelensky is pushing away that opportunity. The Ukrainian people themselves may be more pragmatic than their leadership. Polling suggests a stark divide. Only a very small minority, 11%, according to a recent survey, favor continuing the war. without conditions. Meanwhile, overwhelming majorities favor pursuing talk with Russia. This does not mean embracing defeat, but it does mean recognizing that endless escalation is not the preferred path for those getting forcibly conscripted and those seeing their loved ones get carted off to war. For Zelensky, this creates a dangerous disconnect. Leaders cannot stay indefinitely ahead of their populations without eroding their own legitimacy. To ignore the public's exhaustion while doubling down on maximalist rhetoric risks creating a gulf between government and people. I agree with that. By publicly belittling Trump, Zelensky is shrinking his own stage. He portrays himself as the bulwark of Europe, the last line holding back supposed Russian aggression. Yet without sustained Western backing, Ukraine can't hold indefinitely. And of all Ukraine's backers, the U.S. remains the most consequential, alienating the leader who wants to end U.S. involvement. Whether one agrees with his motives or not is a perilous gamble. Zelensky rhetoric may win applause in certain European capitals. It may even rally the domestic audience for a brief time. But it risks costing him one relationship he cannot afford to lose. Trump is not moved by appeals to shared values or grand speeches on democracy. Certainly not Ukrainian democracy. It doesn't exist. He is moved by respect and recognition of his central role. By suggesting Trump has already caved to Putin, Zelensky undermines both. Zelensky's statements reveal a leader more focused on preserving his narrative than recalibrating his own strategy. Words matter in diplomacy, especially when those words are aimed at Donald Trump. In calling Trump weak, Zelensky may have weakened his own hand. If his true goal is Ukraine's survival, as he says, then it will not be secured through rhetorical bravado. It will require careful diplomacy, acknowledgement of battlefield reality, and avoiding needless insult to the one partner whose departure from the stage could lead to even more disaster for Zelensky than it already created for itself. How about them apples, friends and neighbors? Excuse me. Well, I tell you what, I am going to review that letter I was telling you about in the beginning and see if I've got some anything new on that. And if you wanted to take a look, I wanted to suggest, if the Z-Man happens to be listening tonight, he's probably not, but if he was listening tonight, what I think is that he would be best suited by watching a channel that I watch fairly often. It is called the Military Summary Channel. And I encourage you to go there on YouTube, Military Summary Channel. Every day we get something like this. 7 kilometers to Lyman, Kharkiv has fallen. The strikes on bridges have begun. We get, all of the time these videos get sent out. The offensive intensifies. Markovia has fallen. Legitimate targets. Coalition of the Willing is unwilling. There are plenty of these that he could go back and review at his leisure. And I hope he does. My name is Samuel Trapp. You have been listening to International Flavor with me. Very glad to have you. Very glad to be here in studio for today. And I would encourage you to come back every night at 9 p.m. and listen to me. Listen to all of our other channels. I'm sorry, all of our other content providers as well. And you can listen to me at internationalflavor.com. All of my shows are stored there. Thank you very much.